Hello and welcome to Deep Dive Wine Acoustics, Episode 2, Vina Cabillo. At least that's how I think you pronounce it. I'm Andy Tarnoff. I'm the host of Deep Dive, the publisher, founder of On Milwaukee, and I'm joined by my co-host in this amazingly interesting new podcast, Courtney Taylor Taylor. Renaissance man is what we're calling you.
We don't have to go through that again.
Well, just in case people don't know why we're doing this.
Okay. In case they didn't watch the first one.
Many of you probably know Courtney as the lead singer, co-founder of the Dandy Warhols, but that's just one of this man's talents. What I discovered upon hanging out with him is this guy knows wine like nobody's business.
Maybe that's a bit of an exaggeration, but yeah, I've experienced a lot. I have tasted thousands of bottles of wine.
Tell me what we got here today.
Yeah, I think I would pronounce it Cubillo.
Cubillo, okay.
Or Cubillo, maybe. Okay. It is okay. Spanish. It's 2016. You have one. I have one. We both were able to procure them in our respective cities. You in all the way in Wisconsin and me all the way over in Oregon. So yeah. That's what we're going to try to do is just, you know, always find the same wine, big producers, and keep it in that $22 to $35 range. And we're going to try to find truly great wines that hold their own against wines five times as expensive.
I could be wrong, but I don't think I've ever seen something like this done where people across the country are live drinking the exact same thing, eating the exact same thing, and talking about it in real time. So we might be breaking new ground here. Maybe it's been done, but we're doing it our way.
I've always found breaking new ground is kind of the most rewarding way to fail and not care if you fail. And then other people spend more money ripping you off. And then, you know, like Bowie told me, Courtney, why do you always want to be the first to do everything? When I played Welcome to the Monkey House for him, we played each other's records. We played our new records that weren't out yet for each other on my tour bus when we were on tour with him. And he came out, we walked out of the bus to listen to our new records, and he heard We Used to Be Friends for about 30 seconds. And he just turned and said that to me, why do you always want to be the first to do everything? It's so much more profitable to be the second.
I don't know. That's you know, it's good advice from David Bowie, but at the same time, that song and that album did break new ground. I thought that sounded like something I hadn't heard before.
So. Yeah, I actually had another, well, that wasn't a strange one. That was, I was spending a lot of time with David at the time, but I got a call from Tommy Lee, you know, who's a big electronic music dude. And, yeah, he just wanted to talk to me about it and tell me how much he loved it. And, you know, that he was always hoping that somebody would do that, you know, do guitars correctly with, you know, programmed electronics correctly and be able to blend the two. And there were great bands that came after that record came out, and it didn't, you know, it didn't do that well. I mean, it got some great reviews and then it got some horrible ones.
If not to spend too much time on this before we get into the wine, because that's the important part, but if I'm not mistaken, you guys weren't really pleased with the final mix that came out from Capitol, right? Like, didn't you remix it in the way that you intended it to be?
No, we did. We did our mix. We finished the record, and we worked with the extremely brilliant producer mixer Russell the Dragon Elevato at Jimi Hendrix studio at Electric Lady.
Damn. Okay.
And we had the new president came in at Capitol Records, and he said, this isn't black. It's not black. It's not white. What is it? And I said, you mean like Elvis or Eminem? He goes, you're not Elvis or Eminem. Like, well, apparently we're not going to be on this record, you know, with you in the helm. So he said, can I get a single remixed for radio? And I said, Peter and I looked at each other, and Pete nodded and said, you know, because Pete and I are the founders of the band. And
I
tend to like to look at everyone so that not even Pete and I have to bear the burden of guilt if something should fail, which it almost did. But we said, okay. And he said, who do you want? And I said, I want the mixer who mixed Where's Your Head At, which was a great club-banging English single at the time, and had a Gary Numan sample in it that was ripping. It was really good. Then I got ghosted trying to call them and call our A&R guy, and then one day I got the A&R guy, "No, your record's done. It's finished." Like, "What do you mean?" "We mixed it." "We?" Yeah, so he and Nick Rhodes, Julian Raymond and Nick Rhodes, had gone into the studio with the mixer
I chose. Nick Rhodes from Duran Duran, Nick Rhodes?
Yeah, he and I had done all the final production on the record, me and Fathead and Nick Rhodes.
Okay.
And that, you know, and that's why those synthesizers are really, a lot of them are extremely cool and sophisticated. There are levels of understanding of old synthesizers and owning old synthesizers that Weezia and Pete and I, and, you know, we just don't have that kind of sophistication. Pete has been working on it now for a decade or more, and he's exceptional at that kind of programming and stuff. Now, he's got great taste and skills, but at the time, you know, we got the record back and it was great. You know, like, they did a great job. They did ruin three songs. And I'm not going to say which ones, but you can find our version of it that we did that was too urban for Andy Slater, the brief president of Capitol Records. And it's called The Dandy Warhols Are Sound, A-R-E space sound. Yeah. And so... it's cool. Most importantly, the version of Scientist on that would have been the single. And it is so sticky, icky, icky. The funkiest, dopest thing we've ever been a part of. And a lot of that is hugely because of, we loved the D'Angelo Voodoo record so much that we wanted to work with that producer. And we got him.
Okay. All right. But we used to be friends on that. Your version of it sounds quite different. In fact, it's almost, I think when you guys play it live, you play more of that version of it than you play the one that was on the actual.
The original version?
Yeah.
Yeah. We that one is just a piece of history. It's very cool. And it has more of a Gary Numan kind of approach to it, but super warm and, you know, very funk soul. EQs on the mix. The high end is very controlled. It's the difference between American oak or French oak.
Okay.
French oak is a warm, high end, controlled. American oak is an explosive, screaming, ripping, chalky ride. And that's why sometimes people do like half French, half American, if they want that kind of explosive, bright, high end.
Okay. All right.
So let's get these wines open now.
Yeah, we just digressed a little bit, but that's all right though. Cause I mean, again, there are no shortage of wine podcasts, but there are not a whole lot of rock and roll wine podcasts. So that's what we're doing.
Yeah. Okay.
Time to open this thing.
Yeah. Let's pull the foil off and then, gonna stand up here. And get this guy open. Are you doing it?
Yeah, I gotta tell you though, I got this this corkscrew here from my family heirloom great grandfather. I don't actually know how to use this without corking it, so I'm just gonna use one of these things.
Yeah, this is the traditional Somme key.
Yeah,
if you visit a winery and buy a few bottles, they'll probably give you one with their name on it.
Yeah,
so but it is the classic for a reason. I mean, it's incredibly functional, and our wine is 8 years old, and it's Crianza, which means that it'll be softer on the high end because they probably don't put any new oak into the program. They probably just go straight to oak that's already been used. It adds depth, complexity, stability, and structure. Without adding any bright high-end the dusty, super high end. Now, there are high mids also, which is like the bright acid that wine can have, particularly white wines and bubbles, you know. But this should be a very round and wonderful thing, and maybe even a wine that doesn't need much time in the glass. Like, it might just be pour and drink. So we're going to try that. I would say maybe pour it to the widest, just to the widest part of your glass.
Okay.
Maybe a little more. Then, as I like to say, get your fat mitt around it. I like to do this. And slowly warm it up.
Making all sorts of noises with my microphone here. I apologize.
God, I love that smell. I really love the weird, funky, plummy, old-timey, faraway aroma of Spanish Rioja.
Have you had this specific wine before?
There are so many classic Riojas that have this similar style label that I don't know. I doubt I've had this exact 2016 Crianza. Now, they rate them on how long they spend in oak and what kind of oak. There's Crianza, which is the least age-worthy, and it likes 5 years. We've got eight, so it should be, you know, either on the edge of its existence or in its real prime. I'm smelling it and thinking it's in its prime because it
smells wonderful.
Yeah, it's great. Then there's Reserva, which is new oak, generally maybe months, maybe, you know. And then there's Grand Reserva, which is oaked for a long time. I don't know, maybe a year or 2 years. I don't really know. I've never really jumped in with the Spaniards so much. I also like Ribera del Duero. Is a great region that became very fashionable about 10 years ago. Okay, so let's give it a taste.
All right.
Yeah, that high mid tangy acid is dominating the palate. It's not soft and velvety yet, which is good because that means it's going to change and it'll get better.
Within the course of the time that we're doing this podcast, it's going to change?
Yep. Yeah.
Yeah, I do taste that acidic.
Yeah, it's almost metallic.
Mm-hmm.
Do you get that?
I agree with that. Yeah.
Okay. And that's just generally what wines tend to do right out of the bottle.
I looked up the description of this wine, which, you know, could be bullshit. Maybe not, although it's probably written by someone who knows what they're talking about. And it said it's a clear, bright, ruby color, fresh and slight aroma of licorice with consistent texture and persistent aroma, smooth, fresh, and persistent.
Hmm. Okay. I'm not getting any licorice. Are you?
No.
No, I just really get old school Rioja. I mean, you can break it down into maybe a little clove, a little this, call it licorice, call it that. But overall, I just like the impact of old Rioja, classic Rioja, and it's so different than the smell of any other wine. There is no country that can produce that smell and fool anyone, I would guess. I mean, there's, you know, in Portugal, you can go up in the hills and you can make white Burgundy style wine that I can't tell the difference between. Rioja, I don't know if anyone has ever, well, I don't know if anyone's ever tried, but it is a very special, it's earthy, it's kind of just a dirty,
yeah,
party food, you know, oily soft meats and things. And
I see that.
You know, I also, you eat so much canned seafood in those tins where you roll back the top. like a sardine can, but they have everything, like little tiny squids, just 100 of them packed in there. They're that long and they're just super narrow with a little black eyeball at the end of each one. All vinegared and oiled, light vinegar, good heavy olive oil. And they eat a lot of that. When you go out in Spain at night, the towns and villages really come alive around 9 or 10 p.m. Yeah.
I experienced that in Madrid for sure.
Oh, that's a big city. I tend to think that my memories of Madrid are that it just kind of parties all the time. But the villages seem to, like Aranda de Duero, the main Ribera city. Okay. Yeah, it's a ghost town. And then at 9 o'clock, the mommies with the babies and the strollers and the whole thing, you know, and the dads and the kids and the bars that are half downstairs that are unchanged since the 14th century.
Yeah.
Except for the counters, and they're just making food, and you just buy $3, €3 glasses of this kind of thing, almost exactly. And you get a slab of toast with some puffy orange pink kind of foam sea flavored creature thing smothering it, and those just sit there and they get, you know, gobbled up, and everyone drinks and eats snacks, and
sounds pretty good to me.
I mean, oh my gosh, it is a special. The air, it smells so wonderful, and it's kind of high desert in most of Spain that I've seen. Beautiful.
You said that Spanish wine has its own taste and its own flavor. If someone just handed this to you and you didn't know what it was, could you say this tastes like Spanish wine?
Oh, of course. Yeah, yeah. It's a unique beast, and it's one of those things. And also, I've been told that the part of your brain that recognizes scent is mm-hmm. adjacent to the part of your brain that is memory, your memory bank.
Right,
so
right.
Smells apparently can elicit memories more accurately than any other sense.
So I noticed this specific bottle is a grape blend. It's 70% Tempranillo, 20% Garnacho, 5%.
Yeah, we call it Grenache.
Yeah, Grenache. 5% Graciano and 5% Mazuelo.
I know what Grenache tastes like by itself. You know, it's a tangy, mid-range, bright, zingy, light wine, light-bodied.
Yeah.
But really flavorful, high mid-range, which is probably where we're getting all that tangy, metallic, high mid-range in it. It's like a bell, a silver bell, you know?
Okay.
Ting. And we're on our next... On our next installment, we'll be having Beaujolais.
Okay.
And that is a light wine. I mean, that's a great... We have a Beaujolais Village that we're going to drink, which is slightly more sophisticated than just a Beaujolais. The villages are higher, just higher rated quality, probably spend a little more money on their oak. And they're generally paired with salad. Done. Let's see what it's done. We've been talking for 5 minutes or so.
Okay.
Give it a swirl. Give it a sniff.
It smells sweeter to me.
And yeah, less zingy.
Mm-hmm.
Softer smell.
Oh, yeah, it changed.
Yep, it's getting a little watery. That is because of its... maybe being a few years past its prime because it's Crianza, but good. And I think generally it'll knit together and get a little thicker and more velvety, but yeah, it's softer still. Mm-hmm. That Grenache metallic tang to it.
Less of it though, I think.
Mm,
to my taste.
Yeah.
So if you were buying, if you were, you know, bought this bottle of wine, Would you start drinking it right away, or would you let it sit around for a little bit?
Oh, I think that's more about what's going on in my world at the time. Because it's inexpensive, I would probably buy a couple of them and then would just drink it anyway, even though it's not reached its perfect moment of beauty, you know.
So open it up, pour it in a glass and drink it. Okay.
Yeah. If I had spent more money on it and it was a bit more of like something I could be precious about, if it was like a Reserva or a Gran Reserva. But that has nothing to do with the wine. It just has to do with me.
Speaking of which, so you're in Portland, I'm in Milwaukee. Do you know how much you paid for this bottle of wine? Mine was $31.99.
Yeah, sounds about right. I think it was $32.
Okay.
It might have been a couple more. I think the Beaujolais was 22, so I think maybe it was 34, because I think I spent 56 was my total bill. But yeah, this is a $30+ wine. It's great, and it's only going to get better. Maybe keep swirling it so it warms up, because cold wines are more acidic, or the acid is more prominent at cold temperatures.
Okay.
Yeah.
While we're sitting here waiting for this wine to continue to mature, if that's the right word, or aerate, or...
Aerate, yeah. Open up. I mean, that's just what... Open up.
I'm trying not to sound like a total wine moron here. I mean, I've had enough wine. I just haven't learned to appreciate it yet, which is why we're doing this podcast.
Yeah, I mean, I appreciate any good wine, and it was... very important to me to be able to find affordable, not cheap, but just very affordable wines that are great.
That you can find. I mean, I got mine in Milwaukee at Ray's Wine and Spirits, which is an indie liquor store. But you can get this wine.
We have a local chain that is very similar to how Whole Foods was when it began. And it's called New Seasons, and they're great. And this is, something that they carry, probably always will have one or another year of this same wine at this price.
When you drink enough wine, you're going to get a hangover. Or at least I'm going to get a hangover. Do you find that different kinds of wine, I mean, other than just consuming a moderate amount, but do you buy into this whole like tannins and different kinds of wine give you different kinds of headaches? Or,
well, cheap wines will give you a headache before you even go to bed. I think the key is really forcing the about face and having ice water. I mean, it's a different trip, but it goes down easier for some reason than warm water. Warm water just seems a lot more like sandpaper.
The rating on this wine, what it's worth, from Robert Parker.
Wow.
You know who that guy is?
Big.
Okay. He calls it a 94.
Holy moly. He was drunk. He was drunk when he rated it. He was drunk when he tried it. It must have been the fifth or sixth wine he had quaffed.
Cuz that's a pretty high rating, right?
Like, yeah. 90 just means it's really good. 89 means it's not that great. 90 is this cutoff point, and James Suckling really works that 89-90 thing. You know, he's very clear about if it is well-made wine, you can tell, and if it's slightly industrial level, machine picked, sending it through, making zillions of gallons, and getting it out the door, you can smell it, you can taste it. So for him, 90 is like, wow, this is worth the $28.
Okay.
You know, and that's really his bottom line. And I tend to like that. I'm not really sure how Robert Parker, because he's a little before my time. When I started drinking wine 20 years ago, he was already pretty old guard. He was the main guy, the biggest probably ever in history now, in important wine taster, influencer. And he was really into Napa wines. He was really getting behind what I would consider, you know, jammy fruit bombs. Everyone was calling them Napa fruit bombs at the time. And he really liked that. So I didn't get to live and drink wine during the time when he was a younger man and really spearheading, you know, Bordeaux, Rioja, Burgundy, and then, you know, all the whites, the Alsatians and the Germans, the Rieslings and all that.
But 94 is like spectacular, right? I mean, it's like no one gets 100, right?
Right. Those are the $350 bottles of Napa fruit bomb, you know. Okay. And I've had wines. I mean, I'm good buddies with a dude who's gotten hundreds. Okay. And they are unbelievably good wines, but they can also be jammy and kind of lame. So I'm confused about that. I know what I would rate things as, but it's hard to really, you can never know what another person is going to like. Right.
And that's kind of the whole point of this, is just because some dude says it's a 94, it's what you like.
I would trust anything that got a 94 to not suck.
Sure.
And that's it. I think you could probably think that a James Suckling 90 point wine, some people will go 1 out of 5, maybe even that he gives a 92, which means it's not in no way sucks. It's not a great wine. It's not a legendary wine, but in no way sucks. That's supposed to be the bar right there at 90.
It's a cutoff, right?
Yeah. I'm sure I have had a Rioja that he gave 90 points to, and I thought it sucked. It just reeked of cheap wine. It just had that note, and I can't describe it. I've tried Dirty Copper Penny in Your Sweaty Little Palm. As a kid, I don't know what it is, but it's a cheap note, and you know it, and you know what you're going in, and you better be drunk already and know what you're going to get tomorrow when you wake up. But 94 is way into this is solid. You can't hate a 94. You will.
It's really good.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm thinking it's really good wine. Yeah.
And I also definitely notice that it's getting less metallic.
Oh yeah. Now, okay. Try a little cheese. I'm eating the 1 year aged Manchego.
We got our matching cheeses also, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is scientific shit here.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So these aren't just two guys sitting in their basements fucking around. This is wine science going on here.
Absolutely. Courtney. Very serious. Okay. Oh, my God. With the food and the wine together, that's the magic right there.
That's delicious.
That is amazing. It's so good.
You picked good one, because I would have, you know, I don't know. I judge a wine bottle by its cover.
I think you can a lot of times. I mean, this is a classic label, and I find if they have like kind of an antiquated label, there's less modern fuckery. And it's not going to taste like sour beer with a label like that. I'll tell you what.
No, none of that sour beer. We both agree on that one. It is a cool label.
Really, really great. There's something very Viva la Revolucion about it.
Yeah, it's a good font, actually. It definitely has that revolutionary font. I agree with you.
Yeah, the 1930s or something.
Yeah, definitely.
Good Lord, definitely. It's cool. I'll show it again here, how cool that is.
I like it. Maybe we could make that our font for the podcast.
Yeah, just something like that. I know there's a Sicilian wine that I was drinking a lot of a couple of years ago that had a very similar font, had that kind of, you know, Franco.
Right. It's got, yes, I would say Franco is a sans serif with kind of rounded. Now I'm getting a little. Now I'm talking about things that I'm nerdy about, but yeah. It's
font man.
Font man likes fonts. So you guys are, you're kicking off 30th anniversary tour for the Dandy Warhols. Kind of blows me away. Makes me feel kind of old.
I like to tell people, you know, what's that like? I say, well, it's like 6 years. It's like maybe seven. That's what it feels like. I look at pictures of us. We were children.
We were all children. You're coming toward the end. You guys are coming back to the West Coast and doing.
We thought it would be cute to do small clubs like we used to 30 years ago.
Yeah.
We'll see how cute it is when we're actually there.
You have had a ton of success in the United States, but I feel like you've had even more in Europe and Australia.
Yeah, I think in Europe and Australia, we can, you know, we can sell out, you know, slightly. Our big venues in America are going to be 2,000 people, and our big venues in Europe are going to be 3,500 people.
But you've also played some festivals over the years to 70,000 people and stuff. I mean, is it
sure?
What's more fun?
Oh, it's all fun, and it all really depends on how it sounds to us while we're playing. If it sounds great, if our sound on stage, which is different than the sound that you're hearing out front, if it sounds great to us on stage, it is fun. It is thrilling. It's life affirming. I mean, I can't even begin to find the words to really describe what it does to me.
Fatheads on this tour, right? Because this is a big enough one, so you're not using Patrick
or Eric Hedford. Yeah, Patrick from Rogue Wave was a great drummer, great musician all around.
Yeah, he's a great guy.
Yeah, he's cool. He's really cool. The special awesome human. And then we have Eric Hedford, our first drummer,
right,
who also plays with us. And he's a slightly odd dude. He's really smart and really funny and cool. And his energy is by far the strongest and the most positive of most people I know or hang out with, frankly. And he is that kind of a drummer. We just played with him in Bend, Oregon, and that was incredibly fun. It was about 1,000,000 degrees out. It should have been miserable. And I really think that he was the guy for that gig. He can break through some humidity.
Brent Fathead lives in Australia, so you guys only bring him on the big tours. Is that kind of in the recordings, I'm assuming? Like he didn't play in Milwaukee or Chicago,
right?
This summer, because you know that's a big trip for him.
Hey, are you doing a second glass?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and that one glass. It doesn't start. You don't go backwards as far as when the bottle opened, because obviously if you're pouring it out of the bottle, air is getting in there.
Okay.
And once you open a bottle, you cannot stop it. It is aerating and it will die in hours or days, depending on the structure and strength and age of the wine.
Sometimes I'm a believer that a bottle of wine is a serving size, so I can't imagine not finishing.
Yeah, your friend Molly said, oh, I better get him a stopper or something. And I
think
said,
she was just being polite.
I think what she assumed was we were going to, you know, drink. We were going to open many bottles and do a proper.
Okay.
Compare contrast. And I said, don't do that. I can't respect a man who can't finish off his bottle of wine. And she said, I agree.
Then
I had to clarify that, we indeed were only going to do one style, one bottle per episode.
I promise you that Molly would never assume that I would not finish a bottle of wine, but thanks to her for being our wine mule and picking this stuff up, because she knows what she's talking about.
Oh yeah, she's great. She's great. She's definitely more New World than I am. Sending me a lot of photos of pretty cool stuff that I knew, and then pretty cool looking stuff that I don't know.
Shout out to Molly. Thanks, Molly.
Yeah, thanks, Molly.
Back to your European tour. I think that correct me if I'm wrong, but the song that really blew up for you guys was Bohemian in Europe, because if I'm not mistaken, it was in a commercial or something. And
well, it wasn't in a commercial. It was in a zeitgeist, an ad campaign that was probably the biggest budget and the most global for that era. But it was also at a turning point culturally. And their filmmaker nailed it. And it's called Vodafone. And I think it was the tagline was "Hello." That's it. You know, not "What's in your wallet" or any shit like that.
Right,
it was
right.
Literally just effing hello. And
hello.
And it was just, it was the dream of travel, of international travel. It was fantastic. And it played the song to its best dimension, showing the greatest side possible. And, you know, every commercial has a piece of music on it. I mean, I don't mm-hmm. think you can make a commercial without some music on it of some sort. But this was, you know, and obviously they don't become hits. And this was just absolutely zeitgeist. I just did an interview with BBC One TV a few months ago, Zia and I did, and they just blatantly said that is the song that defined, and they just blatantly said that is the song that defined the decade, the new millennium, and that is
wow.
so flattering, you know, but it did. After that song, after that record, which the record didn't do that well. I mean, none of our records do that well until some miraculous hand of God comes down and props it up and shows it in its best light to everyone in the world. We did great on Junkie, Not If You're Last Junkie on Earth. That was a big song mm-hmm. that got us around the world, but it wasn't as big as that world-changing moment and ad campaign. And then We Used to Be Friends was also huge. And that one is still played probably more than Bohemian Like You. But it depends on the trend. Right now, guitars are coming back and synthesizers are going out again. Yacht rock is long buried and is a punchline
yeah.
in the music industry. So Bohemian Like You is starting to get edge out. You know, it's ahead by a nose again.
I feel like when you play that live, people go apeshit. Like, that's the one where like, you know, I guess every band has that song. But our last episode, I put you on the spot and made you show me how to play Boys Better.
Okay. I don't know. And I'm in my studio, so I've got keyboards, and then down here, the Fender Kurt Cobain model.
All right. I don't think you can see this, but I went on my own deep dive after we talked, and I looked up how to play Bohemian. And I realized it's like it's four chords for the most part, but with this interesting chord pattern and this little thing you do with your pinky. And I was like, wow, that's elegant in its simplicity. And
thank you. I always refer to it as caveman doing Keith Richards.
And also it has a Rolling Stones vibe to it. So
I wanted a Rolling Stones vibe song. I was sitting there in my tiny $380 a month, beautiful antique apartment overlooking the radio cab parking lot and thinking, why don't the Stones make cool records anymore? I don't understand
Amen.
That.
Yeah.
If they could
why
do it,
they do suck now.
If they could do it on Tattoo U, because they were not young men. They weren't 24 when they made Tattoo U, right? They must have been 34. And that's old enough to suck. And that record does not suck. It is awesome. I mean, it's got Slave. It's got Start Me Up. It's absolutely a real Stones record. And Undercover of the Night was sort of a pretty neat song for that MTV sweet spot 80s. You know, they did a good job, but it's not a Stones classic, Stones record, and I don't think they need to keep up and compete with other pop things. I think they should make raw and rough, jagged, you know, Citadel, 2,000 Light Years from Home, She's a Rainbow, whatever. That production apparently was all Keith and Mick, and after Tattoo You, they started having other producers and stopped trusting themselves, maybe, or just didn't like each other and didn't want to go through that. And Peter and I have done that. We have been estranged, you know, at times. And but it's so cool to work again super closely with the person that you put a band together with, that you committed the rest of your life, possibly, and in ours indeed did, to this job.
So when you were writing that song, you had Stones in your mind?
Absolutely. But Keith Richards is a very sophisticated guitar player and a very deep student of the instrument. And so he has alternate tunings. And so it's different, and it sounds cooler when he does it, but I'm not that guy. So I found ways to do it meathead, close enough, seems Stonesy. And then I was a part-time mechanic on antique or old German cool cars.
Right.
Before we got signed to Capital EMI. And as I was sitting there, there was a new stoplight that had just got put in. And one of the first cars to pull up in front of my window, I was on the second floor, was a long, lovely arm with grown out hair piled up that had dark roots and, you know, bleach, kind of punk bleach to it, some fine and minimal tattoo work, and a full on wife beater. Quarter panel, primer gray, maybe late 79, 80, 81, BMW 320i. I've worked on these. And she just pulls up and stops. And I am just sitting there going, oh. And, I often say in interviews about the song, I was single for the majority of my career.
Right.
And always dreaming about the perfect one that was into Victorian literature, that could frame an addition to your house, that could tile, you know, the enclosure for your clawfoot Victorian bathtub or whatever, you know. So that is B. Oh, they're all major, because moving majors around and omitting any minors chords is kind of what the ultimate psychedelic is. A minor seventh, so the seventh of the eight note scale, you drop it a half step, so it's like a minor, but the third is a whole step higher than the second, so that it's not dark and brooding at all, it's bright and zingy. The dark and brooding is the added minor seventh. But so and that's just going, the brightness zingy is on the third, which is your middle finger when you're barring.
Yep.
B in the E formation, but get your index finger up there. And then it is truly the most knucklehead. Well, and then I just sat there as she drove away and her engine did not start steaming, gushing, burning oil and steam out of the hood as I really, truly hoped it would. And I got to run that through my mind, because you know, I was just getting paid a subsistence wage by Capitol Records to do nothing but sit around, smoke pot, play guitar, and live life, channel that through the brain into music, and be part of, you know, the world at the time, at that age. And so that's what I imagined if my luck had been slightly different and, you know, her alternator went out, her fan belt broke or whatever, her ungapped valves seized up.
Right.
I could have gone down there and saved the day. And that would have led to a relationship that I describe, which is a classic 90s slacker experience. And I'm not the only one that's happened to.
I love that story.
Thank you.
I didn't know that. But I do. What I was going to say was the chord progression is so easy, but it sounds so sophisticated.
It's called the rock box. When you hear. Why ain't the right? Okay. So it's rock box. It's a square, yeah. Perfect square.
It's a thing. And then the woohoo! That's Stones. I mean, but every band does that though. I mean, every band's got a song.
And it was
with
so woo-hoo-hoo. Big in the punk era. The Clash did a lot of it.
Yeah.
And it needed to happen. And unfortunately, I'm just not a good enough mimic to make it a Stones song. The vocals are more Duran Duran meets David Bowie. And
that's how I describe the Dandy Warhols a lot.
Duran meets Bowie.
I mean, there are a lot of songs that have a Duran Duran sound to it, and a lot of songs that have a Bowie sound to it.
Mm, cool. Great.
So
I don't hate that. Have you had your fat mitt around it the whole time?
I have not been holding it the entire time. Should I have been?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. It when it becomes, you know, blood temperature, it is like drinking blood to a vampire. Fine. It's so beautiful and effortless. And there are no edges on this wine now. It is a velvet Elvis. It is just coming through.
I got a Velvet Elvis in my studio, actually.
I got, well, we both do. Now we have another one.
I really did. I put it up here because it had like sound deadening qualities. Yeah. I have a literal Velvet Elvis. I'm looking at it right now. It's off screen.
I really should get a Velvet Elvis. There are these great artists in Portland called the Pander Brothers. And, I mean, they're basically responsible through Batman the Dark Knight and Grendel for defining and starting the graphic novel. And they were huge in that mid-90s, you know, beginning era. And the younger of the two brothers, Arnold, went deep into velvet paintings. And that they're Dutch. Their dad it was brilliant, one of the great artists ever of Portland, was of Dutch birth, and his name was Henk, H-E-N-K, Pander. You can look up his stuff, it's fantastic. But the Pander brothers, the younger of the two, has an amazing array of velvets, because they're like the girl with the pearl earring. They're painting out of darkness in that classic Dutch Rembrandt style. And he did it in velvet.
Wow.
So go ahead and look up Arnold Pander.
I'm going to look that guy up and see what he sells.
Yep.
You have a relationship to graphic novels. Am I making that up?
Yeah.
I
have a graphic novel out. That tracks a fictional band that disappeared in 1978 in Berlin.
I'm not kidding. You are a Renaissance man.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. You may not know this by listening to the Dandy Warhols.
When I was in high school, we watched A Man for All Seasons, and I put my hand up and I said, "Does that mean what I think it means?" I was in advanced placement English in probably 12th senior in high school.
Okay.
And our mousy, wonderful Walter Mitty English teacher said, "Yeah, a Renaissance man, a poet warrior, a poet in the winter, a warrior in the summer." And that really connected with me and what I felt I wanted to be. And as a young person, I was very aware that money and that kind of flashy, showy part of having game was not going to come soon. And so as a young artist, your currency or currencies are style, energy, truth, you know, beauty. And I went for it. I wanted to learn how to frame a house, sheetrocking. I was pulling electrical wires through 30-foot runs of conduit and, you know, just learning to do that. And I became a mechanic. And, you know, Peter and I chopped wood one summer. And even that, you look at the crack in a chunk of wood and you say, I can break that in. I can split that into three in one blow. You know, if you do it right, you look at that crack and you're looking at a round chunk of log. Pete was better at it than I was. Pete was always a harder worker, a smarter worker.
Well, you know, when he's on stage, he's very much out of the spotlight.
Oh, he tells our light guy. He tells Poopy, our light guy.
I remember Poopy. I met Poopy.
Oh, yeah, he's fantastic. He was the closest with the Good Place or Good Kind.
Good Kind, yeah.
Restaurant people, because his girlfriend was the owner of Colosso, Julie Colosso.
Okay.
Great restaurant. Going for more, one of the best way. Ever.
Okay.
But Peter tells Poopy, I want to be in almost total darkness all night.
Yeah, no microphone. No movement.
Oh, he has a microphone so that he can clap into it on Used to Be Friends.
Oh, okay. Because you don't hear him open his mouth and he's not dancing around. He's just quietly going about his business.
Yes, he goes about his business. He's got a lot of business too. I mean, he probably has 25 pedals to step on in front of him. Okay, how's that wine going? Okay. Let's get back to wine.
Good. I just poured another glass of it and... Maybe it's because I've just had two full glasses of wine, but I think it's really, really good, and I would absolutely buy this again.
Mm.
How about you?
Absolutely fantastic. Yeah.
Of course, I ask you a question while your mouth is full.
I'm glad we're including cheese. We got cheese with this one. When I got to the store to buy the crackers that we could both get, I had to go into the cheese section to get them. And there they were, hundreds of beautiful cheeses. Knowing that we were going to be doing an 8-year-old Crianza, I went for the 12-month aged Spaniard for cheese. Well, and I'm really glad we did, because it really is like a culinary experience now to have these great crackers and cheeses with this beautiful wine.
Well, that should be easy since I live in Milwaukee, which is in Wisconsin. Which,
oh, I'm sure you can get a lot of Teutonic wines in there.
Yeah.
A lot of
cheese and booze is pretty much what, and sausage beer, is pretty much what.
Beer cheese, you know.
Yeah, beer cheese.
You get cheesy beer soup.
It's a staple.
In gallon jugs.
Yeah.
You get growlers of beer.
It's not untrue. It's a real stereotype.
Beer cheese. Growlers, I'll take a growler of your cheddar IPA soup.
It's all true. Yeah. So it's a real thing. You know what, though? Portland's got that, a little bit of that reputation too, right?
Oh,
now.
Absolutely. I mean, we got the Bearded Man bun, handcrafted beers, you know.
And they, just with legal weed.
And they will charge $40 for a growler of something. if it got, you know, reviewed in international or national beer. We have such a different taste for beer than Europe does, where they've been making it for 2,000 years. Africa's been making beer apparently for 3,000 or 4,000 years.
I had no idea. Well, I guess it makes sense that the, you know, the largest beer company in the world is out of South Africa, but
yeah. Interesting.
Do you still drink beer?
I never did.
Are you?
I like Guinness. It's soft. Okay. It's velvety. It's the most like wine.
Would you sell this in your wine shop or your wine bar?
This one? Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. I should find the distributor, find out who it is, and just offer it by the glass. I mean, the wholesale price must be down around $20.
I think this is a pretty good bargain at $31.99 or whatever I paid for it.
To be able to cough up $30 and know you're going to have this experience is a deal.
So would you give it a 94?
Yeah, I'd give it a 92. That way you know what it is, and you know you're not getting a great Bordeaux, which is far more elegant. I mean, this is a rustic wine. I mean, this is like a Spanish farmer wine.
Describe that to me. Unfortunately, people who are watching this cannot taste it along with us, although that would be kind of cool if they could, but
it has specific flavor and nose. If you had this after a Bordeaux, it would be like that. If you had, and we have done this, I've done this with Ben Kane, who is the winemaker at Toomey Vineyards, and he is a great, legendary Australian-American winemaker. And we went to one of the best restaurants, white tablecloth style restaurants in Portland, and we drank the last of their Bordeaux. Great, elegant, way more refined and restrained, you know, in a profile than this. It has less character, and it's more about the depth. You taste into it. It doesn't come out at you. And this one comes out at you with all this character and everything. But that scene in the Woody Allen movie where he is so disgusted with his intellectual friends that he brings some kind of Hispanic maybe or Italian descent, a romantic country, gorgeous woman. I think she was a prostitute. He just paid her to go to dinner with me. And you know, she's just super out of place with her long nails and her, you know, breasts spilling out and her done up hair and too much makeup. And they're a bunch of like intellectuals and writers and journalists and whatever. And that's what this would feel like after filet mignon and 2002 Santa Emilion or something even more elegant, refined, a St. Julian or Margaux. You would, you know, and we did it. I'm sorry, Mr. Taylor, you've drank the last bottle of Bordeaux. Here's the wine card. What else do you see? And so we kind of went, oh, let's do the Rioja, as they say in Australia and England. And it came out, and we thought it was very funny. It was, you know, it was lowbrow, comparatively. Had we done it before, or had we waited or gone to another place, like a really awesome karaoke bar that's kind of rough, and, you know, places that I would go with, you know, the singers for any of the Portland bands, you know, the Modest Isaac or James Shins or whatever, when we want to get drunk and go sing karaoke. This would be a great wine for that. But it's a great wine if you have loud foods, tangy, you know, cured meats, like I said before, or this great aged cheese that is not subtle at all.
I would agree. It's got like kind of like a blue collar European. What you're saying makes sense. This is not something you eat with a $100 steak necessarily.
Yeah.
You could.
But. Yeah, because if you're spending, you know, $78 on a steak, on a filet mignon, you will not get this flavor out of your palate. You are chewing on then a $100 this, $30 wine. When right. a Bordeaux will cleanse your palate, it'll intrigue you and draw you in, it'll be beautiful and subtle and elegant, and it brings your palate to a focus, to a subtle focus. Whereas Rioja is, you know, game on. It's a good time wine, and you want loud foods, it's a loud wine.
Is it going to change anymore, or do you think we've hit the maximum amount of
it'll change but not for the better. I think we might be at the apex. How long have we had it open? How long have we been swirling it?
About 55 minutes.
Okay. Yeah, that is kind of what I expected, that 45 minutes it was going to bring it on, and it was going to, and it'll okay. stay here for, you know, if you wander off and come back in an hour, it'll be
I just might.
Even slightly maybe softer and nicer.
I think we've drank enough, or should we have some more? I mean, I'm running out of things to say about this wine.
Let's just warm up another little smidge of it.
All right.
Another smidge. And let's do the cracker. I love the Henry VIII sort of swarthy, tacky, indulgent decadence of just having eating food and just putting wine in with it to just wash it down with great wine. It's so stupid.
This is a great afternoon as far as I'm concerned.
But, great. I am going to come visit you in Milwaukee. You're going to come visit me in December.
Yeah, we're going to do something special for the 30th anniversary.
And I'm excited to have us doing this, right? We have two different cameras, da-da-da-da-da. But instead of having two different bottles, well, the same bottle, and I'll go, okay, are you ready to pour? And I'll just pass it like that, and then your hand will go like up it. And receive it.
Yeah. Oh, that's going to be some good content. We got to get some special guests in here, too.
I think that's going to be another. Special guests. I don't know. Maybe. Maybe we'll find somebody. Know.
Yeah, some sucker to drink free wine and talk about themselves. On our next episode, we are drinking Louis Jadot. Beaujolais.
A huge producer, and probably my favorite of that level of massive producer. I feel like they're more consistently good than any other producer of that level. I haven't had one that I truly went, they sold out.
Okay. But this bottle is a little less expensive that we bought than this one. So we'll be interested to see the value to dollar ratio here. I mean, $32 is not a lot for a bottle of wine, but I'm pretty sure this next bottle is, I think it was like $14 or something.
If you got the Village, it's $22 here.
Okay. I think we have the exact same one. That's the goal here.
2022, Beaujolais Village. And we'll talk about that, what that means, Village versus Cru versus just Beaujolais.
This is the part where I'm supposed to tell people to like and subscribe. Because if you don't tell them, they don't do it.
Tell them.
Apparently. So like and subscribe. And send in suggestions, because we have a long list of wine that we want to try and things that we want to talk about, but we're open.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, we love it. I mean, I get to travel the world and have people bring wines to sound check. Show up early, knock on the tour bus door, holding cases of mixed wines. I know you like Barolo. I saw that you, of course, love, you know, Barbaresco and Bordeaux and Brunello and all the big B's of Italy and France. And I get turned on to wines I didn't know, or I just passed over in the wine shop or the grocery store or whatever. And let me say it again, the fanciest wine shops are getting their wines from the same distributors that grocery store, giant grocery store outlets are getting their wines from. So yeah.
You can get this stuff. This is stuff people can get.
Yeah, it's we're just gonna drink gettable wines, and we're gonna tell you what we think if they're great. But I have a feeling we're only gonna have great experiences with wines, just because I've done this so much. I kind of know what words to look for, and that's for my part in this. I want to pass that on, and it pains me to have people drink crap wine for $22 when you can get a Beaujolais Village from Jadot for $22, you know.
Well, I appreciate you, Sherpaing me, being my Sherpa.
Wine Sherpa.
For this, yeah, it's another good thing for your business card. Wine Sherpa through this good stuff. I can finish that. Fish that tonight.
Yeah, it's halfway gone.
Yeah, no. What did Molly say? No stoppers. No stoppers.
Be a man.
All right, Court. Thanks for the guitar lesson. Thanks for this excellent wine choice. This is good.
Yeah, I really like it. Yeah, this is great. We're going young, bright, zingy next time, and I don't drink a lot of that. All right. The only reason I'm doing it is because I got on the bus and there was a great artisanal pizza, or a stack of them, on the tour bus after a show in Southern California. And that's what we had, was this. But I'll tell that next time.
So save that for another one, yeah.
For that episode, yeah. All right, sweet.
All right.
Thanks, Andy.
I'll talk to you soon.
Love it.
All right, thanks, Courtney. All right, bye.